Joining me to discuss the war in Israel is author and activist Norman Finkelstein. Welcome, Norman. So I want to start at the beginning, at October the 7th. I know that's not really the beginning, but I want to start from October the 7th and build from there. And I know it's a simple question. I know it's been asked a lot of times, but do you condemn what Hamas have done on October the 7th?
I make a distinction between the act itself and the perpetrator under conventional definitions. One doesn't have to consult legal dictionaries. What happened October 7th constitutes an atrocity, constitutes a, may even rise to a crime against humanity. I don't know all those technical delineations, most of which are totally meaningless, but certainly atrocities occurred on October 7th, though one has to enter caveats about the nature and the magnitude of the atrocities committed by the Hamas militants. So I don't think there is sufficient evidence to prove that there were beheadings of children, and I do not believe there is sufficient evidence at this point of rapes, aside from what may have been an individual act of rape perpetrated. However, leaving aside those two categories, the beheadings and the rapes, it seems clear that atrocities occurred. However, I'm not prepared to condemn the perpetrators of those atrocities. I won't praise them. I won't condemn them. I won't approve them. I won't disapprove them. I take basically the same position that the American abolitionists took at the slave rebellions that occurred, in our case, the most famous being the Nat Turner Rebellion, in which atrocities clearly occurred. Babies were beheaded and acts of extreme violence were perpetrated against civilians, but the abolitionists, those who oppose slavery, they basically took the position, we told you so, you put people in these inhuman conditions, and it's only a matter of time before they strike out in quite brutal ways.
So whose fault would you put this to? Would you say it's Hamas, the individual members of Hamas who actually killed and slaughtered? And like you said, we don't know the beheadings and the rapes, they could be looked into, but actual murders definitely did happen. So whose fault would you put that to, Hamas or Israel? I mean, like you said, we should put this in context. And the context is the people in Gaza, whether you agree that they're occupied, whether you don't think they're occupied, whatever your opinion is, they are without hope. And a man without hope or a person without hope is a terrible thing and is a terrifying thing. And a lot of people, they are without hope. That's just to give more context. But what's your thoughts on that? Whose fault would you place this to?
There are several questions intertwined there. First of all, I don't believe it's a matter of deliberation or dispute whether or not Gaza is occupied territory. That's a consensus opinion among all international humanitarian and human rights bodies. Gaza constitutes occupied territory. Secondly, as to the characterization of Gaza, already in 2004, the head of Israel's National Security Council, Gior Eiland, described Gaza as a huge concentration camp. And that was before the blockade was imposed in January 2000, before the economic blockade was imposed in January 2006. So those characterizations, it seems to me, are uncontroversial. Now, in terms of assigning responsibility and blame, acknowledging that Hamas perpetrated the acts, I don't honestly believe we'll ever know exactly what happened. There are several possibilities. One, that Hamas included as part of its commando operation a terroristic component. That's possible. They wanted to create a national and international crisis. That was basically what one of the motives of Nat Turner. He wanted to create a national crisis over slavery. Now, that's possible. It was a component of Hamas's commando operation. A second possibility is these young men bursting free from Gaza concentration camp looked for any and every opportunity to exact revenge for the horrors that they had to endure from the day of their birth. Most of the young men were born into the concentration camp. You guessed the average age of the militant was about 20. This occurred in 2023, and Gira Island was already describing Gaza as a concentration camp in 2004. So it could have been, and then we have to leave aside the, as it were, the, how would you call it, this super added fact that periodically these young men were subjected to Israel's mowings of the lawn, these high-tech massacres that Israel in 2000, the best known ones, 2008 Operation Cast Lead, 2012 Operation Pillar of Defense, 2014 Operation Protective Edge, then the mass killings of civilians during the Great March of Return, in particular children, women, medics, and people with disabilities were targeted by Israel snipers. The snipers targeted, apart from killing outright, this was just assassinations of civilians. Israel was targeting the area below the leg of the nonviolent civil protesters, many of them as far as 300 meters away from the border, but the snipers were targeting them. Won't go into all those details now. So it's possible that there was an element of exacting personal revenge given the opportunity that wasn't part of the Hamas commando operation. I don't know. And the third possibility is it seems that the people entered Gaza in waves, and by what was called the third wave, it was simply civilians from Gaza who were going through the breaks in the fence, and they could have included riffraff and ruffians. I admit this is all speculation. I don't think we'll ever know. I don't think Hamas will ever acknowledge the magnitude of the crimes it was itself responsible for, how much of it was individual initiatives by Hamas militants, and how much of it was caused by riffraff and ruffians. We just don't know.
So should those people that committed those war crimes against humanity, like you said, you'll probably be able to call it, should they be punished for those actions? And if so, how would you recommend?
Under international law, they committed atrocities, and under international law, they are held culpable for those crimes. I personally, if I were representing them, and I have no problem saying I would represent them, I would enter a plea of extenuating circumstances, justifying, warranting mercy. And I would enter the plea that there was an insanity induced among these people by the conditions in which they were confined. However, I recognize under the law they are culpable, but there's, in my opinion, a difference between a legal judgment and a moral judgment. And I resonate to the position of the abolitionists. They recognize that the slave rebels committed atrocities. They didn't deny that. On the other hand, they were very careful in their statements not to condemn the perpetrators of the atrocities. And by the way, obviously this will be not known to British audiences, but Nat Turner's rebellion was extremely bloody. It was targeting the order that Nat Turner gave out was kill all whites. Now, Nat Turner is now an honored figure in American history. He's an honored figure in American history. As a matter of fact, I was just reading, if you allow me to get up for a moment. Now, this is an old book. It's 50 years old. I was just reading Nat Turner, edited by Eric Foner. Eric Foner is the top historian on slavery in the Civil War. And he wrote this book. It's a collection of reminiscences and analyses of Turner. And the series it's part of is called Great Lives Observed. That's the title of the series. So I mentioned that because even though when Nat Turner engaged in the rebellion, there was a huge hue and cry. The whites went crazy, sort of like the Israelis now, went lunatic, killed about, the estimate is about 200 black people in revenge for the rebellion. It turns out he now occupies an honored place in American history. I don't know what the verdict, assuming humanity survives, which is problematic, but assuming humanity survives, I don't know what the verdict is going to be on October 7th. Now you say, are you crazy? You just said it was an atrocity. Yes, it's true. I did say it. But I also said Nat Turner's was an atrocity. I was just yesterday night reading a review of a book about Nat Turner by another famed American historian named Eugene Genovese. And Genovese said in the review, he said, there cannot be any doubt that Nat Turner was a great man. I have to say, I looked at that, I had to take a double take. It's completely forgotten what actually Nat Turner did. He committed a series of atrocities, he and his Confederates, atrocities. And yet, even Genovese said he was a great man. So I think the historical verdict, might surprise people.
So, I mean, just in how you're comparing it from Nat Turner, you're comparing Hamas to Nat Turner. I mean, you put Nat Turner as someone who committed atrocities, but someone that could be looked at as someone, a place of honor in history. And you're comparing that to almost Hamas. What do you put Hamas in the same field?
I said it's premature, as in many, the famous remark by the foreign minister of China in the Mao Zedong era, his name was Zhou Enlai. And in the 1970s, Zhou Enlai was asked, what's your opinion of the French Revolution? And Zhou Enlai famously replied, too soon to tell. And you might find that an amusing remark, but actually it wasn't, because China has a millennial-long civilization. So the Chinese leaders tended to think in terms of the very big picture. It's very different in the United States, which has a few hundred years of history. So when Zhou Enlai said it's too soon to tell, it's because he recognizes you need a lot of time to pass before you render a historical verdict. And I think that it's premature to render a historic verdict on what happened on October 7th. And I think we may be in for, if we, first of all, I obviously won't survive for that historic verdict. And if humanity does survive, I think it might be a surprise.
Okay, so just moving on to Israel's retaliation, or Israel's how they've been attacking Hamas since October the 7th. I mean, since then, over 22,000 people have died, over 1.5 million people within Gaza have been displaced. What's your thoughts on that? And I presume you don't have a positive view on that, of course, which I'd love to hear what you're going to say. But as well as that, as well as criticism of what they're doing, what else would you recommend? How else would you recommend Israel to respond to October 7th?
Well, to some extent, it was late in the day. Sometimes acts become it's very difficult to respond. It shouldn't have come to the point that it did. That's the problem. 2.5 million people shouldn't have been incarcerated into a concentration camp. Half of those people were children under the age of 18. Most of the people who burst the gates of Gaza, as I said, were born in a concentration camp. The people in this concentration camp were periodically subjected to high-tech massacres in which thousands of people were killed, hundreds of children were killed. None of that should have happened.
Sorry to interrupt. I'll go back to your question and the answer in a second, but did you call it light in the day?
Excuse me?
Did you say light that you call? What did you mean by light in the day?
Late in the day.
Late in the day.
Yeah. Do correct me if you can't make out what I'm saying. It's late in the day. Now, people say Israel had to react. What did you expect Israel to do? Okay, there's an argument there, but there's a reverse argument. What did you expect the people of Gaza to do? Did you expect that they would passively acquiesce, languish, and die in a concentration camp? So can you really claim to be shocked when the people of Gaza did what any normal human being would do, namely exploit any opportunity to free themselves from this concentration camp? But then you might say, okay, I could see them freeing themselves from the concentration camp, but why do they have to carry out the atrocities? And as I said, it's still unclear and probably will never be clear. What was the relationship between the atrocities and the commando operation? But there, to my thinking, there's another question. The question is, what were they supposed to do? They break free, okay? And then they run. They go run for it like people in the prison break. It was inevitable that they would be tracked down, they would be caught, and then what? So that wasn't really an option once they broke free. A second option, which they did take, was they did exercise, was to take hostages. Now, they're condemned for taking the hostages. That's called another war crime under international law. My opinion is, the 2.3 million people of Gaza, they were all taken hostage. They were all taken hostage for 20 years. The point of imposing that economic blockade of Gaza was to exert enough pressure on the civilian population, create unlivable conditions, such that they overthrew Hamas. Well, that's using, targeting civilians for a political goal. That's called terrorism. They were taken hostage in order to achieve the political goal of overthrowing Hamas. So I personally have to recognize that there is a certain element of legitimacy in taking the hostages in order, A, to free the hostages who are in Israeli prisons, all those hundreds of Palestinians, thousands in Israeli prisons who never had a trial. Part of them are there as administrative detainees. An administrative detainee means no trial, you're not even told why you're in jail. No charges, no trial. That's an
administrative. Every 6 months, then they do a checkup.
And then they can renew it. They can renew it, and it's infinitely renewable, the 6 month administrative detentions. So they're in Israeli prisons as administrative detainees, and then the others are are in prisons because of military trials. And the military trials are just a joke when we don't have to mince words about that. Nobody takes these military trials seriously. So they too were hostages. So it was an attempt to exchange hostages. Is that legal? No, two wrongs don't make a right. I know all that. I know all of that. However, I look at the law and I also look at options. What were the people of Gaza supposed to do? If they broke free and ran, they would have been tracked down, just like there was a major prison break in Gilboa prison, and apparently took incredible ingenuity by the people in Gilboa prison. It was a high security prison. I don't know how they did it. Apparently they were digging for years. They finally made their escape, and within a week they were all tracked down and were right back in prison. So, is that an option? Not my opinion. It's not an option. So what were they supposed to do? I honestly don't know. Are you going to say, are you saying, Professor Finkelstein, that you think they should have killed those innocent civilians? I'm saying I don't know what they were supposed to do. So when you ask me what was Israel supposed to do in reaction to the events of October 7th, I return to the question, what were the people of Gaza supposed to do? What were the people who were incarcerated, immured in a concentration camp, what they were supposed to do? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
But this doesn't help their goal at all.
Well, we don't know that. You see, historical causality, as I'm sure you're aware, is a very tricky business. So let's take the case of our own American, the slavery climaxing the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Nat Turner engages in the slave uprising. Now you might say, how did that help? As a result of it, 200 innocent black people were killed. No question about it. Just like the genocide now in Gaza. The reaction to Nat Turner was this rampage by whites. And then new laws were passed prohibiting any black people from congregating together. New laws were passed prohibiting black people to learn to read, because Nat Turner was very literate. He was apparently a brilliant fellow. So they passed new laws prohibiting people from reading. They passed new laws prohibiting black people from congregating, because Nat Turner acted as a preacher, and it seemed as if he were giving sermons to black people, but it turned out he was plotting with them. So the new laws passed saying no gathering of black people. So sitting in judgment at that time, Eli Hassel back then would have said, what good did it do? But then along comes John Brown, and John Brown, who led another, he was a white man, led another anti-slavery uprising. John Brown says, I was inspired by Nat Turner. And then along comes Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist, and he gives a speech and he says, there's a straight line from John Brown to the Civil War, that he was a critical link in the chain, the sequence of events that climaxed in the Civil War. And inside of the beginning of the Civil War, what's everybody singing? The Union troops, the Union troops. John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. Now, John Brown, he killed innocents. He did, even though he was much more discreet in his killing of civilians, but he did. He did. He was hung for treason. He was hung for treason, John Brown. But then the Civil War begins and John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave. So if you work backwards, Civil War precursor John Brown, John Brown precursor Nat Turner. So I don't know what the sequence of events is going to be now. I know a genocide has been unleashed against the people of Gaza. I assume the people of Gaza in large numbers are going to be very angry at Hamas for what happened, just as I'm sure a lot of those blacks who were lynched and murdered after Nat Turner were angry at him. So I think these issues of historic causality and whether this was pointless or not pointless, I think those are complicated questions which I don't feel I possess the either the moral or the historical equipment to render judgment on.
I get your point. And by the way, on top of, about the Civil War, I think we should ask Nikki Haley for some advice on that. I'm sure she knows quite a lot about it.
Actually, her statement was not outrageous. You see, people, everything becomes a political cause. There is real debate about what caused the Civil War. There was a very great American historian called Charles Beard. And Charles Beard said, you can talk about all the causes of the Civil War and never mention slavery. That's what he said. And the argument there is it was two competing economic systems between the North and the South, and it was the economic competition between two economic systems that caused slavery. Now, of course, the Civil War. Now, I'm sure Nikki Haley doesn't know anything about that. She's an airhead. So I'm not claiming that she knew what she was talking about. But as a general principle, I do think that one should try in analyzing historic events not to turn them into political weapons. What she said was not incorrect, but she was obviously saying it for political reasons. She's from the South and she doesn't want to alienate her right-wing constituency.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back to the point before about solutions for how Israel should respond to October the 7th. Now, I can criticize all day. You can sit there. We can both sit here criticizing all day what Israel's doing. But I think criticizing only goes so far. To do a proper criticism, you need to give a different solution. You need to say this is what would be preferable. So is there no other solution, like ideal solution, you would Israel should have done to react?
Yeah, well, look, the preferable solution is the one that's mandated by international law. Let's start with the beginning. The blockade of Gaza has been deemed a war crime by the international human rights and community because it constitutes a form of collective punishment. So the first thing that should be done is the illegal, inhuman, cruel blockade of Gaza has to be lifted in accordance with international law. Number two, Gaza and the West Bank constitute occupied Palestinian territory. At this point, that occupation is illegal under international law and it constitutes an illegal annexation. Those territories are now integral to the state of Israel. I agree with B'Tselem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, which says that there is only one state from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. That one state is Israel, and that state is based on, anchored in the principle, the tenet of Jewish supremacy. So I would say the next step is that the apartheid system in Israel, which includes the West Bank and Gaza, the apartheid system in Israel has to be dismantled. So you start off with ending the illegal blockade of Gaza. You proceed to dismantling the illegal apartheid regime in Israel. And then you proceed to trying to resolve the conflict on the basis on the principles of international law. I consider myself a person of the left, even the far left, you might say. However, recognize that the consensus framework for resolving the conflict is international law, and if the people of Palestine are willing to acquiesce in that law, then far be it for me to tell them how to lead their lives.
You said a point in a recent interview saying that a couple of years back, you lost hope for the people of Gaza. Mm-hmm. Now, with this tons of a lot of interest in the Middle East, with all this international media attention, do you have renewed hope that there will be peace?
I wouldn't call it hope. Gaza, the northern half of Gaza, according to the Financial Times, has now been rendered uninhabitable. Half of Gaza no longer exists. That's a fact. Half of Gaza no longer exists. It was already among the most densely populated places on God's earth, and now it's by a far reckoning among the most densely populated places on God's earth, because only about, I think the current number is about 160,000 people remain in northern Gaza. Everybody else has been squeezed into the southern part, and the southern part, a tiny corner of that southern part. So half of Gaza no longer exists. That can't be grounds for optimism, obviously, unless you're insane. Half of Gaza doesn't exist. The numbers change so rapidly now, probably about 25,000 people are counted as dead, over 10,000 of them children. That can't be grounds for optimism. I just read today 10 children each day in Gaza lose one or two limbs. There are 10 child amputees, according to Save the Children. There are 10 child amputees every day in Gaza. That can't be grounds for optimism. About 60%.
Well, not for optimism for what's right happening right now in Gaza, but optimism for long-term peace. Like to say, let's say a couple of months down the line, or a few years down the line.
When you factor in the future, you have to take into account the devastation that's been wrought in the present. You can't just set it aside. Yeah, sure. 10 million people, 6 million Jews were killed, but we got Israel. nobody would say something like that.
That's a good point, yeah. You know?
So I'm not going to reckon it. Part of the reckoning has to include what was... what's already been done. And I know people's memories are short because I devoted an entire book to chronicling previous massacres, which just came. They did evoke a large amount of public protest before you were born. Operation Cast Lead in 2008-09, it evoked a large amount of public protest. And then it's forgotten. And then there was the Mavi Marmara, the assault on the humanitarian vessel headed towards Gaza. The killings that occurred there created an outrage, then was forgotten. Then was Operation Pillar of Defense and Operation Protective Edge. They come and go. Then there was the Great March of Return, 2018, came and went. So I can't predict how the extent to which Gaza is going to endure in the historic memory. Right now, if you look at most of the periodicals in the United States, Gaza is disappearing from the headlines. It's dropping on the homepage, dropping.
It's been on the homepage of the BBC for the past, I don't know, quite a few months, every day.
Yeah, but right now, at this moment, it's dropping, at least in the US periodicals. I don't want to speak for the UK. There are two things to be said. Any reckoning of the future has to take into account the horror of the present. And number two, we just don't know how it's going to end. We don't know exactly how it began, what was the goal, the objective of the Hamas commando operation. And we don't have any idea how it's going to end. And guess what? It may end with you and me ending. If it escalates with Hezbollah, and right now the Israeli provocations are of a high order, that could set off a chain reaction, which will be the end of humanity. It's actually quite easy to imagine that. That's not a far-fetched scenario. that Israel attacks Hezbollah. Hezbollah is reputed, I can't say, I don't know, to have 150,000 rockets and missiles. They start targeting significant sites in Tel Aviv. Israel decides it's facing an existential threat, and it rolls out its nuclear weapons, and it decides that since Hezbollah is a subsidiary of Iran, we're going to attack Iran, which Israel has always wanted to do in the first place, and it nukes Iran, and you could see where it starts heading.
Yeah, I mean, Iran has been relatively quiet in the, during this conflict.
Well, it's said that behind the scenes, it's not been quiet. Iran clearly did not want a war. I mean, that's obvious. Didn't want this whole thing to happen. It's already forgotten just a few days before October 7th. They had just negotiated an agreement with the United States, with U.S. returning, I guess it was $6 billion, Iran releasing hostages, as they were called. And so Iran no doubt saw that as an augury of maybe resuming somewhat normal relations with the U.S., which the Hamas attack on October 7th obviously sabotaged. But what they're doing now, and their fears that if Hamas is dealt a crushing military defeat, that Hezbollah will be next and Iran will be third, because, you know, the Israelis views this occasion as every other occasion that arises as a pretext for saying, let's attack Iran. And they've been saying that now, you know, in the last 3 months. Even supposedly sane, I think insane, historians like Benny Morris have been busy proposing, exhorting the U.S., let's attack Iran now. So I can't make any judgments. First of all, it's too soon to tell, because we don't know how it's going to end, let alone what will be the consequences. We don't know what the end is going to be, so we can't even calculate the repercussions and consequences.
Yes, that makes sense. So if there is, let's say there is a, somehow there's a peace negotiation, or there's somehow, do you think Hamas can be part of that?
To me, that's a kind of strange question, if you'll forgive me.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm asking that. I'll give you the reasoning behind that. So Israel's reaction to October the 7th is saying Hamas cannot exist. There's no chance for peace.
I'm completely cognizant of that fact. But let's look at the numbers. Hamas killed about 1,200 people. 36 of them were children. Now, we're told Hamas's actions disqualify it from any settlement of the conflict, to be participants, negotiators, in a settlement of a conflict. Israel has killed about 10,000 children, not 36. Israel has launched a war, a genocidal war. It was very clear about what it was doing. It made no bones about it. It said, we're not going to let any food, water, fuel, or electricity into Gaza. Well, what are they saying? Now, they didn't only say it, they did it. Right now, the estimates are around 60% of Gazans are suffering from starvation. That's a result of not letting any food in. Israel targeted hospitals with no military justification whatsoever, none. Human Rights Watch put out a report on Israel's systematic, methodical targeting of hospitals. It said they had no evidence that there was any military justification for it. Now, in the annals of modern warfare, I don't think you can find a single example of a state, as a matter of state policy, targeting hospitals. This is crossing a new negative threshold in barbarism, what Israel did. So, and I can go through 1,000 numbers, 1,000 statistics, making comparisons, even with the U.S.-British bombing of German cities during World War II, even the bombing of Dresden. And by all reckonings, Israel is in a category all itself. It's just, at this point, it's a monster state. No question in my mind about it. There isn't even a single Israeli, not one single Israeli soldier who's refused to serve in this genocide. Not one. Gideon Levy wrote a column about that a couple of days ago. Not one Israeli soldier has refused to participate in this genocide.
I mean, you wouldn't really know. No one would know. It could be very quiet.
Well, no, you have to say, I'm not going to go. And then you go to prison, you know, where nobody's done that. 60% of Israelis in polls, 60%, or to be exact, 57%. 57% say Israel's not using enough force in Gaza. That's a remarkable figure. There's no comparison between the intensity of bombing in Gaza and any other conflict, even during World War II, the intensity of the bombing of Gaza. Remember, Gaza is just 26 miles by 5 miles. You take any other case, Afghanistan, Iraq, the wars in Serbia, Bosnia, what's that area called? I can't remember, it just slips my mind. There's no comparison in terms of the intensity of the bombing. There have been many, many articles written about it, comparing the bombing of Iraq over 10 years, comparing the bombing of Afghanistan the first 3 years. And everybody did all these different kinds of comparisons. There's no comparison with what Israel has done. Bear in mind, they're bombing a concentration camp. Bear in mind, half the people they're bombing are children. Half of Gaza's population are children. Bear in mind, 70% of the people of Gaza are either refugees or children of refugees from the 1948 war. So, my question is very simple. Doesn't require a degree in moral philosophy or astrophysics. If what Hamas did on October 7th disqualifies it, how can what Israel has done since October 7th not disqualify it? I just find the idea that what Hamas did is a disqualifying act, but it doesn't, what Israel has done is not a disqualifying act. I consider that completely insane. I really do. I consider it completely insane. If killing 36 children is a disqualifying act, what is killing 10,000 children? I asked that question to Piers Morgan when I was on his program, and many people commented underneath. They said he immediately went for a break. He never answered the question. I was very clear. I posed the question just as I posed it to you. And he then said, okay, we're having a break, and never answered it. You know why he didn't answer it? He's a perfectly, you know, intelligent person. You can't answer it.
I mean, there's a chance he could have been just on a break, but I think you've given a very clear answer to that question.
And then he could have come back to the question after the break, but he changed the subject.
Yeah,
I guess you've been watching yourself.
Yeah. So I just want to bring it. I just want to ask a question, really related to just more current matters in right now in America. So the other week, or I think it was even the other day, the president of Hamas, President Gay, resigned. What's your thoughts on that?
I think one has to look at these things in context. And you're going to have, if you don't mind, there's going to be a digression here. We have a principle in the United States. I don't know exactly how it plays out in the UK. It's the principle of academic freedom. And academic freedom, the essence of the principle. And by the way, Bertrand Russell wrote quite eloquently on the subject, because he himself was the subject of a witch hunt in the United States. He lived here during the war, during World War II. And he had gotten a position at the City University of New York to teach philosophy, logic, I think history of science, I can't remember, three areas. And he held heterodox opinions on things like sex and religion. He believed, which was a scandal at the time, that people should cohabit before marriage. He thought that was a good thing. He thought that homosexuality should be legalized. He was obviously an atheist. And so a witch hunt developed to prevent Bertrand Russell from teaching his areas of expertise and eminence. And so he wrote in the issue of academic freedom, and the essential principle of academic freedom, the building block is only your peers possess the qualifications to judge your competence. So you'll understand that who should judge whether a person should teach physics? Should it be a billionaire? Should it be a religious figure, a pastor or a priest? Or should it be other physicists? Who should be deciding that? So Eli, what's your opinion?
I mean, that's based upon what you said, I presume Piers.
Yeah, and that's the basic, that's the building block, the tenet of academic freedom. And so Bertrand Russell's position was, if the philosophers at City College thought I was qualified to teach the subject, I should have the right to teach it, and all my other opinions and so forth are beside the point, okay?
But isn't it different to what's happening right now?
Sure. Yeah, allow me, if you don't mind, I know I'm monopolizing the time, but just permit me. Now, how did the principle of academic freedom arise? It arose at the beginning of the 20th century in the United States, when there were all these, what we call them, robber barons, the rich and the super rich. They were millionaires then, now it's the billionaire class now. And at that time, there was also worker resistance to the development of industrial capitalism in the United States. And there were a handful of professors who were sympathetic to the workers' plight and the workers' cause. And the robber barons tried to get them thrown out of the university. And that's where the principle of academic freedom, and also the organization, was called the AAUP, American Association of University Professors. That's when it emerged. Okay, that's the historic background. What happened in the case of Claudine Gay and also President McGill of the University of Pennsylvania? What happened? After October 7th, there were protests against the Israeli genocide in Gaza. And there were the billionaire class, the robber barons, Jewish overwhelmingly, I think with one exception, Jewish. The Jewish billionaire class, it didn't like those demonstrations. So it called on President Claudine Gay and President McGill at the University of Pennsylvania that they had an obligation to suppress those demonstrations. And the presidents weren't sufficiently obedient to the suppression of these demonstrations. And then the billionaire class, in this case, the Jewish billionaire class, they said, we're going to withhold our contributions. And those contributions were very significant. So we're talking about $100 million here, $50 million there, another $100 million. It was, to put it very simply, and I see no reason to use euphemistic language, they were blackmailing the universities. They were blackmailing them. Now, you might say, well, these are private institutions, and if these people want to give, they can give, and they don't want to give, they don't want to give. That's true. I agree with that. But then you should just say, I'm not going to give money. But when you're publicly threatening the university, if you don't suppress these demonstrations, we're going to withhold our money. That's blackmail, in my
Well, can I
opinion.
understand your point there, but can I ask your actual thoughts on
Okay.
what the presidents had to say in front of Congress? So they asked the
Okay.
question, right? They asked the question, would they call for the
Yes,
genocide of Jews as
right.
spelling out harassment? And they said, depends on the context. What's your thoughts on that
Okay.
answer?
Yeah. Eli, I'm perfectly happy to answer your questions because I think they are important questions. First of all, if I were the president answering, I would have said, but that's a purely speculative question on the order of should the professors in the anthropology department have the right to have a Roman orgy with their students during Christmas break? Is that a relevant question to be asking at a congressional hearing? There is no talk about genocide against Jews. I mean, the whole idea is so completely insane. If you've ever been in a college campus, the idea of mass demonstrations in favor of genocide is just nutty. Because I never had an academic position, I was always going from one campus to another where anyone would take me. So I know college campuses. The idea on a college campus of advocating genocide against Jews is completely insane. It's like advocating Roman orgies for anthropology professors with their students over Christmas. It doesn't happen. So, had I been testifying, I would have said, with all due respect, Congressperson, I don't know what you're talking about. There were people who were advocating intifada. Actually, I lived in occupied territories and in the West Bank during the first intifada. Intifada, as a technical term, meant when a dog shakes off its fleas. And so it meant for the Palestinians that they were finally, after decades of acquiescence or quiescence, rebelling. The Intifada was completely nonviolent. That was its redeeming quality. These were nonviolent civil resistance to the Israeli occupation. So when you're saying Intifada, Intifada, what that meant was nonviolent civil resistance to the Israeli occupation. That's what Intifada was. What, pray tell, does that have to do with genocide? It's just completely crazy. And the other slogan which they objected to is "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Personally, I don't like that slogan. I don't. I've said it. I'm not afraid to disagree even with my comrades and even those with whom I'm in solidarity. I think there are elements of ambiguity in that slogan such that I don't think they should use it. Should they be allowed to use it? The answer is yes. Just give me a half moment. I want to read something to you. The first thing you have to remember, Eli, is that the United States is a very different place than the UK. In the US, the Nazi Party is legal. You know, I grew up, my parents, as you know, were Nazi concentration camp survivors, and we lived and we never protested. There was never even an issue. We lived in a society where the US Nazi Party was legal. And we all even knew the name of the head of it because he was eventually assassinated. I can tell you now, it's 60 years later, but I remember George Lincoln Rockwell. And then there was a very famous incident in the United States when the Nazi Party wanted to march through a Jewish neighborhood in Chicago, Illinois, called Skokie, Illinois. And our Supreme Court ruled the Nazi Party had the right of assembly to march through that neighborhood. Now, you might find all of these decisions appalling, but they are facts of how what is our tradition of civil liberties. And The Ku Klux Klan is legal in the United States. It's not been banned. It's a legal organization, a white supremacist organization. It's legal in the United States. So you have to bear in mind what is our constitutional history and our constitutional system. The United States, if you're a patriot, let's say you're an American patriot, okay? In our country, you're allowed to advocate the violent overthrow of the government. Now imagine if you're a patriot, how you feel about that. Yeah, you are legally allowed to advocate the violent overthrow of the government. There's a long constitutional history on that. It began at the beginning of the 20th century with the Bolshevik Revolution and, all the anarchist parties and Bolshevik parties, and whether they had the right to legally advocate the overthrow of the government. So before you render judgment on what Claudine Gay said, you have to bear in mind, which many people don't know, what is our constitutional history and what is the current state of the law on these questions? Now, a lot of people don't even know the Nazi Party is a legal party in the US. They don't know that you're allowed to advocate the, when I was your age, I was an extreme leftist, and I
Aren't you
was
an extreme
about,
leftist? Aren't you an extreme leftist even now?
excuse me?
Didn't you say you're an extreme leftist now as well?
What I'll say is, in that era, we called for the movement which I associate, we called for the violent overthrow of the capitalist system, and we called for implementing the dictatorship of the proletariat. And those were very essential points of our worldview. Now, of course, I fear the consequences of me getting killed in the midst of this armed revolution, but we never even thought twice that we were allowed to articulate those opinions. It was just taken for granted. You're allowed, I'm on college campus, I'm giving speeches calling for the violent overthrow of the government. We never thought we were going to get arrested for that. Maybe eavesdrop, yes, that's possible. Maybe phones tapped, but we knew we had the right to advocate those sorts of things in public. Remember the Black Panthers, the Black militant organization. You know what its slogan was? At every rally, you raise your hand in a clenched fist and you chanted, "Off the pig." You know what "off the pig" meant? Kill the cops. Off the pig. That meant kill the cops. Go Google it right now. Just put it "off the pig," Black Panthers. That's our tradition. That's our constitutional tradition. So the other day I was looking at.
I said, do you mind if I go back to the question? Now, I get your points, but do you mind if I go back to the question? So on, sorry.
So the two points are, number one, the presumption of the question put to Gay was that students were advocating the genocide of the Jewish people. That's completely insane. It never happened. It never came close to happening. It was never part of anybody's mental universe that they were advocating that. Number two, even if they were advocating it, under our constitutional system, they have the right. So, to give you an example, give me one half second. There was a case of a fraternity in Oklahoma. It was called Sigma Alpha Epsilon. And to quote from a book, a respected book, in March, members of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon fraternity at the University of Oklahoma were on a bus, dressed in formal wear, going to a fraternity event. Two students led the others in a racist chant. There will never be a nigger at SAE. There will never be a nigger at SAE. You can hang him from a tree, but he'll never sign with me. There never will be a nigger at SAE. And the authors of the book, prominent civil libertarians, professors, defended the right of those students to say that. You hear me? Yeah. Defended the students' right to say that. The book was, we're not talking about ancient history. The two authors are very prominent in the legal field. It came out in 2017. So, when Claudine Gay said what she said, that's the law. Or at least that's the civil libertarian position. So, I said, I don't like the slogan from the river to the sea because I said I believe it's open to unacceptable interpretations. It's too vague and open to unacceptable interpretations. So do you know what I do? Brace yourself. When I meet with Palestinian students and other activists, I sit and patiently try to explain to them why I think it's a bad slogan.
Yeah.
It's called persuading. It's called trying to convince. It's called exercising free speech in order to persuade and convince. And what happened next, of course, is old news. The same folks then did everything they could to discredit Gay, found evidence of plagiarism, and she
I just want to make a point. So you, in your answer, you mentioned that they should be allowed to say it. But I think that, but the actual question from the senators was, is calling of the genocide of the Jews, is that called bullying or harassment? Not whether it should be allowed to be said or not.
Well, their answers were very precise on that point. I disagreed with Gay when she said statements like intifada, intifada. She said those are horrible, terrible, awful statements. But she said you have to make a distinction between my personal beliefs and me speaking as the president of an institution. And that's factually true. I don't agree with her personal beliefs. There's nothing wrong with intifada, intifada. As I said, from the river to the sea, it's a gray area for me. I've said it on your show already twice. But she was correct. What she and McGill said were correct. You don't, as an administrative officer, impose your opinion on others. I don't even believe, I'm a pretty strict fundamentalist on this thing. There's a position that's called institutional neutrality, and it comes from this University of Chicago principle enunciated by a guy named Calvin. I can't remember his first name, is Harry or Harvey Calvin. I think Harry Calvin. And basically what institutional neutrality was, as an institution, they should take no position on anything political. They shouldn't take any position on anything political. I happen to agree with that opinion, because the moment the university starts taking positions, it starts stifling free speech, because you get afraid. You know, people go to college, they need recommendations, and you know the whole deal. And so they're afraid of, if the university says you shouldn't say this, or it's wrong to say this, then you get intimidate, and a college environment should be one that enables the maximum of free speech, free inquiry, free exploration. And so I support the position of institutional neutrality. I don't think the school should have taken a position on George Floyd. I don't think they should have taken a position on Ukraine. I don't think they should have taken a position on October 7th. But if you're going to take a position on October 7th, when 1,200 people were killed, then I think you should also take a position on everything after October 7th, when about 25,000 people were killed in the genocide. But let's leave that aside. I'm not for taking positions on anything. The university should be neutral. And that's what the president said. They said, I might have a personal opinion, but as the president of the university, I shouldn't be taking a position. Now, it could be argued against them that people like Claudine Gay have taken positions in the past. And because she's a very woke, she belongs to that woke identity politics culture. I would have said that was wrong. You shouldn't have done it. So I think that was a mistake. I'm against, as you know, I'm totally against this whole woke cancel culture moment.
Cancel culture from which side? The right or the left?
I'm against it on all sides. I'm against the cancel culture when it targets conservatives, and I'm against the cancel culture when it targets Palestinians. I'm against it on all sides. There are some instances where I can see regulating speech. I don't think you should have the right to call a student, dumb nigger, dirty kike, ugly cunt. No, a professor shouldn't have the right. But technically, that's speech, But I don't think they should have the right to say that in a college campus for the simple reason that once you enter onto a college campus, you're basically, there's a quid pro quo. We're here to pursue truth, and you don't have any right to suppress any expression which contains a kernel of an idea, even a kernel of an idea. But if it contains no idea whatsoever, it's just the equivalent of a verbal club. And I would include under verbal club, dumb nigger, dirty kike, ugly cunt. Those have no content. They have no intellectual content. They're just verbal clubs. And I think in the college environment, you can, that is legitimately suppressed. That's why I don't agree that thing about SAE and no nigger is going to be, I think that could be legitimately banned. I don't agree with the civil libertarian position on that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on. Just before we end, I just want to ask you one quick question. So I know it's been floated around online a bit, but would you debate Destiny? I hosted a debate between Destiny and Cenk Uygur the other week, and it went really well. Mm-hmm. And I asked him live on air, would he debate Destiny? And he said he would do. I was wondering if you would be willing to debate him. Asked him, would he debate you? And he said yes.
I offered to debate him once. He didn't show up. And I don't feel,
moderate it if.
Excuse me.
I don't mind moderating it between you and Destiny.
No, with all due respect, Eli, I don't want in any way patronize you or condescend to you. So I want to choose my words with care. There's a genocide occurring in Gaza. For me, it's not about views and shares. Of course, I want to reach as broad an audience as I can, but I don't want to participate in media spectacles. I wouldn't debate a person named Destiny. I wouldn't debate a person named Charlemagne or all of these media characters. It's not who I am, and I think it's disrespecting of the people who are dying to engage in a media spectacle in order to accumulate more likes. I don't even know anything about the social media, but more views, likes, and shares. I just don't participate in that. I've debated Benny Morris on air. I've debated Israel's foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami. I've debated a large number of characters. Most of them won't debate me, but that's not my problem. But there's a difference between that and where, Shlomo Ben-Ami, the Israeli foreign minister, actually that was substantive. But there's a difference between that and a media spectacle. And I don't want to be part of it. First of all, because it's demeaning of the people in Gaza. They should become the object of a media spectacle. And second of all, with all due respect, it's demeaning of me. I devoted the whole of my adult life to studying the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I'm not particularly proud about that fact, incidentally. I wish my intellectual range were much broader, but that's not the way my life turned out. I'm not debating a character whose knowledge of the subject is taken from Wikipedia. It's not not serious in my point of view, and somebody who goes around the web. I want to debate Finkelstein, and apparently he had these kinds of, I don't know, I've never watched him, I don't know who he is, had these seminars with his cult following where they were looking up facts together. That's not scholarship. Scholarship is a, I can tell you from a lifetime's experience, it's a very solitary exercise. It means sitting in a room with books and poring over them and with intense concentration. It's not a media spectacle to study, to cogitate, but to organize what I'm told, I don't know, I'm told he organized his followers, let's find things to, you know, gotcha things with Finkelstein.
As far as I know, you're referring to a live stream where he does research.
Yeah, I have no idea. I'm telling you what people told me. I have no idea. Okay? I don't know who Destiny is. But that's not what I'm about.
Yeah. No, I respect that. So just anyway, thank you so much for coming on. I of course don't agree with everything you say, but that's the amazing thing about having a conversation. Thanks for coming on.